literally burnt alive in their tents. The trauma stabilization team that we work alongside have received people with varying degrees of injury.
He said that the airstrike is the worst he's seen in the weeks he's been working in Gaza.
You know, the timing of this strike comes just after the International Court of Justice ordered the Israeli military to halt its campaign in Rafah, and also after Israelis are protesting for their government to negotiate a ceasefire to bring hostages home. Given all that and everything else, what's the state of negotiations to end the war?
I mean, for weeks there have been talks about the talks. Israeli media is reporting that officials say that negotiations are supposed to resume next week. There were some high-level discussions in Paris this weekend. The Mossad, the CIA, and the Qatari Prime Minister were all there. The talks have been breaking down over and over again in the past months, and Prime Minister Netanyahu is under great domestic pressure to come to a deal to release the remaining hostages in Gaza, but he's also being pressured by hardliners in his government who don't want a complete ceasefire.
That's NPR's Hadil Alshalchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A protracted battle over perceived Russian influence is playing out in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Today, a parliament committee rejected a presidential veto of a Russian-style foreign agent bill. The full legislature could follow suit as early as tomorrow, and it is expected to have enough votes to allow the measure to prevail. Critics say the bill would limit media freedom and a sign of Russian influence in Georgia that could derail the country's plans to join the European Union. The legislation has ignited protests in Tbilisi and prompted the State Department to announce visa restrictions against Georgian politicians linked to the bill. U.S. senators are also weighing sanctions. So how influential is Russia now as its invasion of Ukraine continues? My co-host Leila Fadel spoke earlier with Alexander Gabuev, director of the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center.
I want to start with Georgia. This so-called foreign agent bill that has people protesting there, it would require media organizations and NGOs that get more than 20% of their funding from abroad to register as foreign agents. It's very similar to the law in Russia that's been used to jail journalists. Is there any evidence, as critics say, that this legislation is a direct result of Russian influence?
We don't know that. We don't have any evidence, but it's clear that Ivanishvili, who is a de facto ruler of Georgia, the oligarch who stands behind the ruling party, appoints the prime minister and has vast control over the country, is an autocrat. He models his rule in Georgia after Vladimir Putin, and he takes a lot of hints and best practices from the neighboring regime. And at the same time, he wants to distance his country from the West and maintain control, being more friendly to Russia than many of the predecessors, including government of President Mikhail Saakashvili.
Now, it's been met with a lot of opposition. Georgia's president vetoed the bill, saying it threatens the country's path toward joining the EU. Is that the case? And how does this moment benefit Moscow?
It is indeed the case. The U.S. has announced that it will sanction members of the ruling party and members of the Georgian government who are involved in passing of this legislation, including their family members. There is a very strong opposition, and there is a very clear case that this legislation will take Georgia away from path of deeper integration into European and transatlantic family and closer to Russia. Russia definitely is interested in that.
Now, Georgia is one place, one example, but is this indicative of a larger Russian strategy to consolidate power as the U.S. and the European Union continue to try to isolate Russia over its war in Ukraine?
What we are talking about in Russia's neighborhood, where Georgia is located, is that Russia has a lot of staying power. It has multiple tools to inflict pain on the countries that want to distance themselves. The extreme case is Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But Georgia is sandwiched between Turkey and Russia, and despite Russia's occupation of 20% of Georgian territory and very strong anti-Russian feeling, Russia still has a lot of tools to inflict pain, and that's where Ivanishvili navigates. And it's true also for Central Asia, for many other countries like Armenia, Azerbaijan, and also Moldova. Globally, I think that Vladimir Putin really instrumentalizes divisions between countries in the global south, their dissatisfaction with the West, current war in Gaza, in order to move out of this isolation and build as many partnerships outside of the coalition that supports Ukraine fight for its independence.
Is it working?
It is working. We've seen that a lot of countries have voted in the UN to criticize Russia's annexation of Ukrainian regions. But at the same time, they maintain ties with Russia, they trade with Russia, they help Russia to circumvent sanctions. And that's not only authoritarian countries like Iran, North Korea, or China, but also the largest democracy in the world, India, or countries like Brazil.
Now, the West sees any Russian expansion ideologically, geographically, as a threat. What is the end game for Russia, though?
I think that Russia wants to steer divisions between the West and many countries in the global South and non-West in order to create more maneuvering space and ultimately undermine the U.S.-led international order.
Alexander Gabuov, he's director of the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
The war in Ukraine is not only destroying the lives of many humans, it's also disrupting the lives of animals.
One of them is the greater spotted eagle.
It's this amazing, huge, charismatic eagle that specializes in pretty remote wetland environments. They've largely gone extinct from Western Europe.
That's Adam Ashton Butt. He is a senior research biologist for the British Trust for Ornithology. He says there are less than 10,000 greater spotted eagles left in the world.
Many live in the wetlands and forests of Belarus and Ukraine.
Southern Belarus is one of their strongholds, where there's over 300 breeding pairs.
But the war in Ukraine has complicated the eagle's migration to their breeding ground in Belarus. The male greater spotted eagles usually travel there in the winter from East Africa and the females from Southern Europe. To get to Belarus, they go through Ukraine.
Usually they go quite directly and stop over at these wetland sites to kind of refuel on the way.
But since Russia's full-on invasion of Ukraine in 2022, researchers started to see something different.
They were taking a lot longer to migrate. They were going less directly, so they were kind of moving in a less of a straight line. And they also weren't stopping over at their usual refueling sites.
He says the loud noises from shelling, explosions, or troop movements were causing the birds to change their migration path to zigzag erratically.
I think something akin to panic is probably what's going on.
Russia drops thousands of bombs and launches hundreds of drones toward Ukrainian targets each month. The eagles eventually get to their destination, but only after flying up to 60 additional miles.
The increase in flight and the later arrival at their breeding grounds might mean that they're less fit and they've got less energy to breed successfully.
This is especially important for a bird like the greater spotted eagle, which is considered a vulnerable species, Ashton Butt says.
They only have one chick per year and their breeding success is around 50%. So if they miss out on breeding for a year, then it can really impact the population, which is relatively small.
These findings are detailed in a study co-authored by Ashton Butt and published this month by the journal Current Biology. But how conflict impacts animals is not widely known, mostly because of how dangerous gathering data in the field can be.
Ashton Butt says what is happening to the greater spotted eagle is evidence of the impact people have on nature and why migratory bird populations are declining around the globe. This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. Glad you're with us. It's 8:19 on this Memorial Day. Lots more to get to still this hour on the program. We all know about Hamilton, obviously, Alexander Hamilton, the founding father, and the musical that was very, very popular, still is. However, there's a new book out, The Hamilton Scheme. We'll hear from the author, who will tell us about some little-known facts that he learned about Alexander Hamilton along the way. That's just ahead on WPR.
There was a time when subprime meant cheap steak and inflation worries were limited to the air pressure in your car tires. Things are a little more complicated now, but understanding the issues doesn't have to be. Marketplace helps you decode the economic news that matters and leaves the clutter to the other guys. It's the business show for the rest of us.
Tonight at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Young Automotive, Inc. and Neff's Pianos. Businesses play an important role in our communities and in funding quality news, talk, and music on WPR. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
I'm Gregory Berg, encouraging you to subscribe to the new Morning Show podcast, which can be found on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts, to receive a different morning show 7 days a week. Remember to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
Morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In weather for today, we'll see highs in the 60s and 70s across the state, mostly cloudy, and a chance for some spotty showers starting in the north, but appearing in the south later on as well. More of the same tomorrow, clouds, some spotty showers, and highs in the 60s across the state. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday. With AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR. From BritBox, dedicated to helping people discover a world of British TV, including new original crime thriller After the Flood, from the producers of Happy Valley. Streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement designed by gastroenterologists to help relieve occasional bloating, gas, and abdominal discomfort. More at AlignProbiotics.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The historian William Hoagland set out to write a book about Alexander Hamilton, a founding father many Americans think they already know.
It's sort of more like, well, he had a marriage, he had an extramarital affair, he was killed in a duel.
Those are big plot points in the long-running musical Hamilton. And I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hoagland's new book dwells on something the musical mentions, but not in detail. It was Hamilton's plan as the first Secretary of the Treasury under President George Washington. Hamilton was obsessed with the public debt, money borrowed and owed by the federal government.
This is a tricky issue because public debt sounds to us sometimes like, oh, well, that's a problem. To Hamilton, the public debt was a massive opportunity for kind of consolidating the United States.
Hoagland's book, The Hamilton Scheme, describes why Hamilton increased the national debt. He got the federal government to take over the debts of the original 13 states. The U.S. took over paying those loans the states had taken out during the American Revolution. Rich Americans had loaned much of the money, and Hamilton wanted to bind that wealthy class to the new nation.
And to Hamilton, it was more like, wow, if we can feed that desire on the part of the rich class of Americans to get regular interest payments, not just now, but for years to come, i.e. foster the debt, and yoke that desire on the part of the rich Americans to great national interests, to great national ambitions, well, then we will have consolidated the country, connecting a very active investing class to the aims of the country.
I want to say out loud an underlying idea here that I think I don't always understand, and maybe a lot of people don't. When someone loans money to the government, we may think they then have power because the government owes them money. You're saying it may actually work the other way. The lender may become dependent on the government because they're getting payback from the government and they need it.
Yeah, this is what the vision kind of was. You know, you could see it as mutually beneficial, but it's only mutually beneficial if both sides are playing. And Hamilton definitely wanted to find ways to make the lending class dependent on the federal government, not on the individual state governments.
So I was wrong about this as a kid. I read about this as a kid because I was a dorky kid and my mom had history books. And I read something about Alexander Hamilton and the federal government assuming the state's debts to pay them off. And I thought that was about good credit and honor and sticking up for the United States and showing we had a good reputation in the world. You're telling me that wasn't really the point at all.
No, I don't think I am telling you that exactly, because I think it is about good credit. And by establishing this debt as a thriving thing, which is what Hamilton did, well, that did give the country good credit abroad and at home. So this enables further borrowing down the line in the case of emergency like war, for one thing, but also in a more steady way to fund things like infrastructure and other giant national projects. So I don't think this idea that he had was in any way in conflict with the idea of good credit. It's just that, you know, how do you get good credit? Well, you get it by making sure that the people who are going to lend money feel really comfortable and really connected to you, the borrower.
You make another point about borrowing money. When a government borrows money, they can use the money to build stuff like roads, things that grow the economy, and don't have to wait to pay as they go as money dribbles in.
Yeah, and this is not something Hamilton made up himself, of course. This is one of the ways the British Empire had found ways to pay for big projects, big expansions, without constantly trying to fund each thing by its own sort of set of taxes or whatever. Create a pool of loaned money, and you tax in order to fund that pool rather than taxing project by project. And this kind of unleashes power to expand. Britain had done it. France was into it. Hamilton found ways to do it in a different kind of country, to fund roads and infrastructures, to fund wars, to fund expansion into the territory of indigenous people, and all the other things the United States was into at that time.
So let me ask about current events in this context, because I just looked it up, and one recent figure for the U.S. national debt, this is money owed by the federal government that we have to pay back over time, was recently $34 trillion, which is an awful lot of money, and people sometimes very fiercely criticize that. When you think about Hamilton's principles, as well as his opponents, and you try to think about that huge debt we have today, are there ways that a giant debt can be good?
For Hamilton, he wouldn't have put it that way, a giant debt. He would always say a public debt, if not too large, can be good. But compared to what some of his opponents wanted, the debt he defended was indeed quite large.
I'm also thinking of another aspect of this that maybe applies in principle to the present day. We're in a situation where China has loaned the United States enormous amounts of money by buying U.S. government bonds. We often have a public discourse where we feel that China has influence over the United States. Is the opposite also true? China has an interest in the success of the United States because their money is over here.
Right. Again, looking at that from a Hamiltonian point of view, yeah, I think so. I think from a Hamiltonian point of view, you want foreign investors. That's one reason you're trying to establish good credit generally, is to be able to get those people interested. I think there are resonances and echoes that the 18th century formation of the country can help us think about.
After immersing yourself in Hamilton, did you come away liking the guy?
Like is a, you know, people read some of my stuff about Hamilton and they think, you know, people think I hate him because sometimes they read stuff that he did and they think they hate him because they're reading about it and they think this guy must hate Hamilton. You know, I don't know if like's the right word. There's no way I could have spent this kind of time with the character that I hate. I was into him, you know, before the musical made him a giant cultural phenomenon, and I'm into him now. And the more I look into him, the more fascinating I find him, the more complicated and compelling, and that's what I'm trying to kind of bring out.
William Hoagland is the author of The Hamilton Scheme, an epic tale of money and power in the American founding. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. It's been really fun. And I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. And yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry. And I'm not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot.
This is NPR News.
When journalist Jong Park was leaving California for Seattle, he wanted to say goodbye in a unique way. So he did the stretch from LA to San Francisco on a road trip, but only on public buses and trains.
I had to download 4, 5, 6 apps because each public transit system had its own app.
Hear about his 38-hour journey on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story plus the day's news from 3 until 6:30 today on WPR.
This is WPR News.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad you're with us. It's 8:29 on this Memorial Day. News from NPR and WPR starts next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Health Ministry officials in Gaza say at least 45 people were killed in an Israeli airstrike in the city of Rafah yesterday. NPR's Lauren McGaughey reports dozens of others were injured during the attack.
The strike hit late at night and caused a fire to spread through an encampment where Palestinians had been sheltering. Images sent by NPR producer Anas Baba show the charred remains of makeshift dwellings and children digging through the rubble to salvage food and supplies. Baba spoke to families who fled here because it was an area not under evacuation orders, an area where the Israeli military had said humanitarian aid was available.
Everyone here is just like deassembling the makeshift tents that they do have, and they don't know exactly where to go.
The Israeli military says it was targeting and killed two senior Hamas officials and that it's investigating the incident. Lauren McGaughey, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
In Ukraine, a Russian airstrike hit a hardware store in the city of Kharkiv yesterday, about 20 miles from the Russian border. Ukrainian officials say at least 14 people were killed. The South Pacific nation of Papua New Guinea is asking for international help to deal with the aftermath of Friday's landslide. Local government officials now say more than 2,000 people were buried under tons of rubble. That's roughly three times the number that was estimated yesterday. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. If you missed the Aurora Borealis earlier in May, you're not out of luck. Margaret Faust reports sightings are predicted to be more common in the coming months.
The sun will reach the peak of its 11-year activity cycle sometime between now and November. As solar activity picks up, glimpses of the aurora borealis across Wisconsin are predicted to be more intense and more frequent. Brian Brazier is with the Space Weather Prediction Center. He says the particulars are hard to nail down far in advance.
A lot of what we do is really waiting to see an event on the sun, and then we can analyze what we believe its impact to be.
The storm that made the Northern Lights visible on May 10th was the strongest one of its kind since 2003. The events have the potential to impact the electrical power grid and satellites. Margaret Faust, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A group of returning students in Milwaukee got a second chance last week. About 300 people graduated Milwaukee Area Technical College's GED and high school equivalent program. Samara Al-Sabiki was one of the graduates. Al-Sabiki only attended high school for 3 months before dropping out. After having a daughter at 19, she said she realized she made a mistake, but working several jobs and caring for her children made it difficult to return to school. Now 40 years old, Al-Sabiki says she knew it was time to go back for her daughters.
I eventually said, you know what, I'm going to do this. But I hesitated a lot. The embarrassment of going back to school. Honestly, I did it for them because I know it's going to better our future.
Immediately after graduation, she re-enrolled at MATC and says she plans on becoming a medical coder. A conservative University of Wisconsin regent says he will not step down when his term ends this month. Then-Governor Scott Walker, a Republican, appointed Robert Atwell to the Board of Regents in May of 2017. His seven-year term ends this month. Atwell said in an email last week that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss reminded him of a 2022 state Supreme Court ruling that said political appointees do not have to leave their jobs until the state Senate confirms a successor. So far, Governor Tony Evers has not named a potential successor who would still need to get confirmed by the Republican-led state Senate. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Schwab, with Schwab investing themes like artificial intelligence, renewable energy, or pet passion, over 40 themes to invest in. Learn more at schwab.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. South Africa's ruling party, the African National Congress, is facing its greatest challenge yet in elections this week. The party has been in power since the end of white minority rule in 1994, but it's predicted to lose its absolute majority for the first time. At the core of all this is frustration with staggering unemployment, poor delivery of basic services, and by some measures, the highest income inequality in the world. To get a sense of what people are talking about ahead of the elections, NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu took a short but telling journey in Johannesburg.
I'm in Alexandra, or Alex. It's the oldest township in South Africa, and it's the morning rush hour, or spitty pitty in Zulu, meaning chaos. And it's pretty easy to see why. There are dozens of vehicles swarming into the same junction. It's pretty much every person for themselves. Traders are beginning to set up wooden stores along the sidewalk. Workers are clearing heaps of trash lining the roads. The day's really just getting started in a part of the city that reflects South Africa's journey over the last 30 years. This township is on a vantage, overlooking a stretch of high-rises, a short bus ride away in Sandton, often described as the richest square mile on the continent. During apartheid, Alex was home to the black underclass in one of the few townships near the white-dominated centre of the city. The end of white minority rule brought the promise of a new reality in South Africa. But since the end of apartheid, it has become one of the most unequal nations in the world. Togozan Luando drives a minibus taxi, the main source of transport for millions of people in South Africa. His daily route from Alex to Sandton captures the country's divide.
So my question,
he tells me he's always voted for the ANC, and probably still will. But he feels more conflicted. He doesn't believe they will bring better days in South Africa. But he doesn't know if he can vote for the other parties either. More than 30 political parties are contesting the elections, where the ANC's Cyril Ramaphosa is seeking re-election as president. The main opposition is the Centrist Democratic Alliance, or DA, often seen as representing the interests of the white minority in South Africa. But other smaller parties have made headway, most notably the Umkhonto Wesizwe Party, or MK, led by former ANC President Jacob Zuma, and the radical left-wing Economic Freedom Fighters Party, led by Firebrand leader Julius Malema. These and other opposition parties threaten to chip away at the ANC's majority in parliament for the first time, amid widespread frustration with high unemployment, corruption, and rising crime. We don't have a government, he tells me. They failed us. The ANC failed. Luando has been driving the minibus mostly along this route for the last 25 years. It's a 20-minute journey through gridlock between Alex and Sandton, and yet the distance feels far greater. On the minibus, I meet a man who calls himself Doctor, who commutes to Sandton every morning. He's more optimistic about the direction of the country compared to Luando, our driver.
The country is in a good direction. It's just that some things are beyond our control in terms of like the oil prices. We don't control that. And our inflation is mainly affected by that. But the country, like we are happy with our country.
As he says this, the passenger next to him rolls her eyes. A few minutes later, we arrive in Sandton, which feels like a world away. Clean, wide roads are lined with high-end restaurants, hotels, and gleaming apartment blocks. We reach the final stop, but before we disembark, I talk to another passenger, Tenulo Moyeng, who works as a brand ambassador in Sandton.
It's very bad here in South Africa. We are working to survive. The only thing is to work and hope for the best, but this country is not getting any better. It's just drowning.
She's 34 and part of a generation that either barely remembers the final years of apartheid or was born after it was abolished.
See how many youth are sitting, roaming the street. Some are becoming criminals because of the situation here in South Africa. You go to university, you don't get a job. Then, yeah, what is the use?
Moyeng is one of the lucky ones who's employed. The majority of the country's 62 million people are under 35. And nearly half of them are without work. Last year, the unemployment rate was the highest in the world. And with the state of the country, Moying says she's lost faith in politics.
You used to vote for ANC before?
Yeah, I used to, but not anymore, unfortunately. I will be sitting at home.
Is this the first election where you won't be voting?
Yes, this one, it will be the first one. I don't see the use.
Talking to Tenulo Moyeng really brought home the challenge that the ANC is facing. And the ANC know that they have a fight on their hands. It's the last days of the campaign, and they've been going all out, campaigning non-stop. It's also been enlisting the help of party giants. I caught up with one of them, Tokyo Sekwale, a major liberation figure who spent time in prison on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela. He was campaigning at a shopping mall on the outskirts of Johannesburg, and he shrugged off the competition from other parties.
All elections are full of contest. The US election right now is the most contested in the world, with two old men trying to rule the White House.
He made a small dig at the US election. Then he turned to the ANC's chances. He was upbeat and praised their record, but admitted they had made big mistakes in office.
We believe that we will prevail because this is the only organization that has governed for the last 30 years with mistakes, and with certain serious ones as well. Secondly, it's the only organization that has delivered so much for people, and the ANC touches the lives of the people. We are saying about the ANC, what a touch.
30 years ago, the ANC election posters promised, quote, a better life for all. This time around, the slogan is a less ambitious quote, let's do more together. The party is on the back foot, and even if it manages to keep its majority this election, going forward, its grip on power is under real strain. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Alexandra, Johannesburg.
Coming up later on All Things Considered, what blockbusters, thrillers, and thought provokers does Hollywood have in store for the summer? Critic Bob Mondello has his summer movie preview. To hear the story, listen to NPR on your smartphone, smart speaker, or on your radio. Hey, let me ask you, any movie this summer you really want to see?
Yep, Inside Out 2. There's going to be new emotions. The character is a teenager now, so you got anxiety, envy, and embarrassment. That's all me, Michelle. That's all three things. They're me to a T.
What recommendations do you have for me?
How about Deadpool and Wolverine?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
I can't.
I don't
think
that's me.
Michelle.
That's not me. That's not me. This is NPR News.
And this is WPR News. Good morning. Glad you're along with us. It is 8:42 on this Memorial Day Monday. Still a few more stories to get to this hour before news coming up at about 8 o'clock. And then, of course, Wisconsin Today afterwards. Still to come this hour on the program, it's been 100 years since the 1924 Immigration Act was signed into law. We'll hear about that law and the act itself coming up here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You tune in to Wisconsin Public Radio for news you can trust, conversations that draw you in, and weekend entertainment. The largest source of funding for everything you value on WPR is listener support. Join the team that makes WPR possible. Become a sustaining member. Start your ongoing monthly gift and share WPR with your entire community. It's easy to sign up at WPR.org/donate. Thank you.
Support for WPR comes from UW Health and the Mount Horeb Area Arts Association. Businesses play an important role in our communities and in funding quality news, talk, and music on WPR. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. A trusted resource since 1999, the ADRC is a no-cost, one-stop shop for older people, adults with disabilities, and their families. For more information, call 262-605-6646.
On Wisconsin Public Radio at 8:44, here's a look at what's happening in news. Powerful storms killed at least 18 people, injuring hundreds and leaving a wide trail of destruction across Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. Those storms are now moving east. A state of emergency has been declared in Kentucky. A tornado was spotted northwest of Fort Atkinson in Wisconsin around 6 last night. Another was reportedly seen near Milton. Tornado warnings were in effect for other southeastern Wisconsin counties as well. This after 5 tornadoes were confirmed to have touched down in the state just last week. And the U.S. Forest Service is granting Woodland Dunes Nature Center and Preserve near Lake Michigan money to protect the federally endangered rusty patch bumblebee. More news available at WPR.org. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Ion Television, presenting the Scripps National Spelling Bee. The two-night event airs Wednesday, May 29th and Thursday, May 30th at 8, 7 Central on Ion. Learn more at spellingbee.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Z-Quil Pure Z's gummies, designed with melatonin for occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep naturally. Learn more at zquil.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Newspaper closures hit less populated rural communities especially hard. That's because often there's no replacement if a newspaper shuts down and no place to turn for important local news. But several towns in rural Kansas are bucking that trend. Their lifeline is a resilient printing press that's been in business for more than 100 years. Here's Kaylin Moore of the Kansas News Service.
Liberal, Kansas, population 19,000, is in the rural southwestern part of the state. It's about a four-hour drive from Wichita, the state's largest city. In Liberal, there's an unassuming warehouse that contains something increasingly rare for a sparsely populated area, a printing press churning out thousands of newspapers. The operation produces nearly 20 weekly papers for some of the small towns in the region, plus Liberal's own paper, the Leader and Times. Workers change out the metal plates used to print images for each of the different communities. It's all part of the effort to slow the growth of news deserts where people can't find local news. Earl Watt, owner of Liberal's paper, says it's an essential part of the community.
There are certain fundamental things that make a town. One of those, in my view, is a newspaper.
Watt has been in the business for more than 30 years. His symbiotic relationship with the surrounding papers, desperately trying to stay open, allow him to keep his own paper in print.
Having their local newspaper keeps the community pride high. It keeps the community engaged and informed.
A Northwestern University report on local news found that over the past two decades, more than 2,900 weekly newspapers have closed down due to costs and low readership. In Kansas, over half of the state's counties have either just one newspaper or none at all. That's according to a study by the Center for Innovation and Sustainability in Local Media. But having a printing press nearby keeps newspapers like the Huguenin and Hermes going. Huguenin is 30 miles down the road from Liberal. Co-owner Reglinda Coulter says not many news outlets would care about some of the stories they run, like the triumphs of local middle school sports.
I've lived here all my life, and one of my other partners has too, and we read the Hermes when we were little kids, and I would hate to see it go away.
Coulter and two other women bought their town's paper in 2007, and it hasn't been easy. They struggled keeping up with finances, staffing, and even sexism. So what's the point of going through all that trouble for a newspaper in a town of a few thousand?
They cover the city council meetings. They cover how tax dollars are being spent while also informing the community about how they're being spent.
That's Emily Bradbury, executive director for the Kansas Press Association. She says newspapers also play a critical role in local politics. For example, in towns without a newspaper, fewer people ran for mayor and also fewer voters turned out for local and national elections, according to a study from the journal Urban Affairs Review. And with polls showing trust in the media at a historic low, Bradbury says local media can be key to restoring trust in journalism among rural communities.
They see it as a huge difference between their local paper and their local journalists versus, quote-unquote, the mainstream media.
Back at the printing press in Liberal, Lisa Diaz and a co-worker fold and bundle the papers by hand, idly chatting and listening to the radio. It's a human touch that small-town papers still rely on. Diaz has lived in Liberal most of her life. She says she hopes these newspapers enhance the sense of community in the region.
In all the counties around here, I think they need to stick together and
kind of put us on the map.
And that cooperation has led to these communities not only staying on the map, but also staying on the page. For NPR News, I'm Kaylin Moore in Liberal, Kansas.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. 11 minutes left in the hour now. Really glad you're along with us for Morning Edition here on WPR News. If you're looking for any more news, you can always find it on our daily news podcast. It's called Wisconsin Today Morning News. And of course, we have a show coming up after this that's called Wisconsin Today, starting at 9 o'clock, all here on WPR News.
I'm Gregory Berg. The studios at WGTD will be closed on Monday, Memorial Day, so there will be no morning show broadcast. But there will be a morning show podcast, and Patrick K. O'Donnell will be featured talking about his book, The Unknowns, the untold story of America's unknown soldier and World War I's most decorated heroes who brought him home. The morning show podcast is available through Spotify, Apple Podcast, or Google Podcast. Be sure to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
In sports, the Milwaukee Brewers lost to the Boston Red Sox yesterday, 2-1 the final score in that one. The Brewers are now 3.5 games up over the Chicago Cubs for lead of the division, and the Brewers and Cubs will open up a series this afternoon in Milwaukee with first pitch set for 3:10. The Milwaukee Admirals beat the Grand Rapids Griffins yesterday to win the playoff series. The Admirals now move on to the Western Conference Finals, where they will play the Coachella Valley Firebirds. That starts Wednesday night in California. In weather, we'll see highs in the 60s and 70s across the state today. Mostly cloudy, chance for spotty showers starting in the north, but appearing in the south later on as well. More of the same expected tomorrow. Cloudy and cool with high temperatures in the 60s and a good chance for some spotty showers across the state. Different story by midweek, though. Wednesday, mostly sunny conditions return and no rain in the forecast. This is WPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. 100 years ago this week, the U.S. enacted a sweeping immigration law that changed the course of history. The 1924 Immigration Act created a system of quotas for immigrants based on race and nationality. NPR's Jasmine Garst has this report.
If you'd grabbed a copy of the New York Times back in spring of 1924, you would have read this headline: America of the Melting Pot Comes to End. The opinion article by Pennsylvania Senator David A. Reed lamented immigration from places like Italy and Poland. These new people, Reed writes, speak strange languages. Our incoming immigrants should be of the same race as those of us who are already here.
Between the 1870s and the middle of the 1910s, about 23.5 million people immigrated to the United States, mostly from Europe, also to some extent from Asia, and some from Latin America.
Professor Andrew Sandoval Strauss teaches history at Penn State.
These were mostly people who were Catholic or Jewish or Orthodox, and the people who had all of the power were Anglo-Saxon Protestants.
There was enormous support to keep immigrants out. In 1924, the governor of Georgia gave a speech at a Ku Klux Klan convention.
And he said, quote, "I would build a wall of steel, a wall as high as heaven, against the admission of a single one of those Southern Europeans."
Anti-Asian sentiment had also been rampant for decades, along with laws banning Asian immigrants. Professor Beth Lou Williams is the director of the program in Asian American Studies at Princeton.
There was a concern that the white race was actually vulnerable in America, and that intermixing could produce racial degeneracy.
By 1924, Senator Reed co-authored the Immigration Act, and what it did was set quotas, limits for how many people could come in from specific countries. There were no quotas for Asian immigrants, who were already largely excluded from entry and citizenship. Mexicans were not restricted to a quota system. They were seen as indispensable for agriculture. The act was signed into law on May 26th. The system became a reference for other countries.
Adolf Hitler specifically praises it as recognizing that the foreign and, you know, the strange blood in a country must be limited or cut off.
It wasn't until 1965 that the act was replaced by the Immigration and Nationality Act.
This bill says simply that from this day forth, those wishing to immigrate to America shall be admitted on the basis of their skills and their close relationships to those already here.
That's President Lyndon B. Johnson at a ceremony at the foot of the Statue of Liberty. It's a pretty stunning backdrop, but
Johnson wasn't exactly thrilled to embrace immigration reform.
Professor Maddalena Marinari is a historian of immigration from Gustavus Adolphus College. She says the civil rights movement and Cold War geopolitics had a big part to play.
For him, the most persuasive argument was, this just looks bad, right? You can't on one hand say that you are the defender of democracy around the world and have a racist immigration law on the books.
The 1965 Act ushered in a new era of immigration to America, but historians say some of the anti-immigrant rhetoric today is similar to that of the 1920s. Here's Professor Sandoval Strauss again.
Almost exactly the same things were said by Anglo-Saxon Protestants about Italians as are being said by many people about immigrants, especially from Latin America. So in the 19-teens and 20s, you would have heard people saying that Italians are all criminals, right? That they are the sort of peasant scum of the old world.
1924 was a long time ago, but in many ways, he says, you can still hear its echoes. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
When graduates of the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth walked across the stage earlier this month, they got more than just a diploma. They were surprised with envelopes of cash. But the money comes with a catch. NPR's Rachel Treisman has that story.
One of the speakers at UMass Dartmouth's commencement ceremony was Robert Hale Jr., the president of a telecom company and part owner of the Boston Celtics. He was honored with an award for his philanthropic work, but it turns out he was there to give students more than just advice.
Each of you is getting $1,000 cash right now.
As he spoke, security guards carried two duffel bags on stage.
Listen, there's a stipulation. Hang on.
The applause went on for half a minute before Hale could get to the big reveal.
The first $500 is our gift to you. The second $500 is for you to give to somebody else or another organization who could use it more than you.
Hale knows something about giving. Forbes estimates he's worth some $5.4 billion and has donated millions to charitable causes, including hospitals and schools. And he's actually pulled off this same surprise at four Massachusetts colleges 4 years in a row. It started when he was asked to give a commencement speech in the height of COVID. Hale and his wife Karen wanted to give students something extra special.
Some of the most joyous times in our lives have been when we've had the chance to share. We thought if there's a way that we could create that seed within another generation where they would get to experience the joy of giving, then maybe that becomes something that they would strive to do and make us all a little bit better along the way.
Hale heard that one UMass student donated to a local charity that gives holiday gifts to kids, the same charity that brought her joy several years ago. A spokesperson for the state school says graduates have so far given to a women's shelter, a children's theater group, and a relative's cancer treatment, among others. Hale thinks that the best cause that any philanthropist can pick is one that they'll want to support in the long term.
Everybody has somewhat limited resources, so if you're sharing them, it better be something that tugs at your heartstrings.
And for Hale, that could include future commencement giveaways. He says there's been no shortage of invitations. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
This is Morning Edition on WPR. Thanks so much for being with us on this Memorial Day. It's 1 minute before 9 o'clock with news on the way.
Support for WPR comes to more than 50,000 individuals and families in Wisconsin and beyond. Your investment in Wisconsin Public Radio means that research-based journalism, interesting conversations, and uplifting music and entertainment are available to all. Thank you.
Support for WGTD's local news and public affairs commitment comes from Casey Family Options, a tradition of trust. For more information, including how to get started and pre-planning, visit caseyfamilyoptions.com or call 262-653-0667. Your gateway to public radio is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wisconsin Public Radio from